Physics World.
Hello, welcome to Physics World Weekly. I'm James Dacey, and coming up today, we're focusing on measurements and precision in physics. Physics World's Hamish Johnston has recently returned from Colorado in the US. And while there, he took a trip to the city of Boulder in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. That's where he visited one of the sites of the National Institute for Standards and Technology, or NIST as it's more commonly known. So what's the what's that location like then, Hamish, near the Rockies?
Oh, it's absolutely lovely. And I should apologize to listeners for my croaky throat. I think I picked up a cold. But it was worth it, definitely. Yeah, Boulder is a lovely place. It's about maybe 30 miles northwest of Denver, and it sits right up against the Rocky Mountains. So, you look out your hotel window, and you can see the mountains coming right down into town. It reminds me a bit of Grenoble. In Grenoble, the mountains sort of come right down into the town. It's very similar to that. And of course, like Grenoble, Boulder has a very long tradition of science. It was really nice. And when I was there, there was a sort of a spring blizzard that had struck the night before. And so when I walked out to NIST in the morning, everything was covered in snow, and of course the mountains were snow covered as well. So it's a beautiful location. Yeah, and I caught up with a friend of mine afterwards who used to work at NIST years ago, and he told me that he and his mates, including one of the people that I interviewed, they would go running up into the mountains from NIST.
Pretty inspiring place to work then.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
So the people there, your old mate and everyone else who works at NIST, they're busy developing sort of range of measurements and research tools for physics and the wider world. What sorts of people work there? Is it just scientists, or the name itself sounds almost a little bit bureaucratic.
Well, the people that I met, and I think probably it's because I was on a tour for Physics World, tended to be physicists and engineers. Mm. But it is an interesting place that developing standards. It could be something as mundane as making sure that when you go to the supermarket and you buy it would be a pound of mints. You're actually getting a pound. It's that sort of thing.
Yeah.
From that sort of end all the way up to, the world's most accurate atomic clocks, that lose, maybe a second in the lifetime of the universe, that sort of thing. So it's a broad range of standards that are being developed by a range of scientists, mostly physical scientists and engineers.
So I suppose looking beyond the mundane stuff, the meat at the meat counter, things like atomic clocks and finding a way of really accurately defining the second. Why is that important beyond physics? What can wider society gain from that?
Well, I suppose even today, we use atomic clocks on a regular basis. When you use a GPS on your mobile phone, the timing there is very important because you're looking at signals coming from space and the timing, and that tells you your position. And that is all based on atomic clocks. They're not the most accurate atomic clocks in the world, but they are very good, and they make GPS possible. And even the use of the mobile phone network is based on very precise timing. And one of the things that I learned at NIST is that you can put atomic clocks on a mobile phone tower. Now, normally, a mobile phone system gets its timing information from GPS satellites. But if there's a problem with the GPS satellites, the tower can actually have its own atomic clock sitting on the tower that would kick in and operate for an hour or 2 hours to allow the system to run without the timing signal from GPS. So you might think that these atomic clocks are just so precise that we'd never actually have any practical use for them. They are, we use them every day
So, I mean, talking about atomic clocks then, while you were there, I know you caught up with a few of the researchers, and one of those people was David Hume, who's actually developing a new generation, a new type of ultra-precise atomic clocks. Is that right?
Yeah, he's looking at aluminium, or aluminum, as he would say, ions that are trapped and used as a very precise timekeeper. And this is actually a really interesting story because apparently aluminium ions have some really good, have some really good benefits for building atomic clocks. But there's also some problems. And so the way they get around these problems is they entangle the aluminium ion with another ion, and that allows them to read out the clock. I think if they just had an aluminium ion, it would be very difficult to read out in their setup. And the other interesting thing about this aluminium ion clock is that even though it is very, very much sort of cutting edge research, they actually trap it on a chip. And when I went to David Hume's lab, he showed me this tiny chip where, you know, they trap these ions. And I find that interesting because that suggests to me that even when they're in the early stages of developing these clocks, they're sort of thinking, you know, how can we package this up? Mm. How can we, send this out into the world as a practical device? That, who knows, you know, maybe in times to come, these ion clocks will be on satellites and they'll, you know, give the best GPS ever.
Okay, well, let's hear what David himself has to say about the new innovation. So Hamish caught up with David in his lab, so you can hear in the background lots of vacuum pumps and other scientific equipment clicking away. Here's what he had to say.
So talking about atomic clocks in general, the second is one of the fundamental units in the SI system. And the second is defined by atomic clocks. In particular, it's defined by a particular frequency, resonance frequency, in a cesium atom. And that's accepted all around the world as the standard for time. An interesting thing about atomic clocks is that they can realize this second with greater precision than any other unit of measurement that we have. And it's not just a little bit greater precision, it's orders of magnitude better precision than any of the other fundamental units in our system. In addition to that, the second is used in order to define some of the other fundamental units. So it underlies most of the fundamental units in the system, and it can be realized with much greater precision. We're in a really interesting position right now with the development of new atomic clocks, in that we have a whole new generation of optical atomic clocks that are moving from the microwave frequencies, which are used with the cesium atomic clocks, to optical frequencies that can be driven with laser beams, driving transitions in atoms. And because they have a much greater frequency, they also have, everything else being equal, a much greater precision and accuracy. So we have a lot of experiments around the world that have demonstrated even better precision and better accuracy, again, by a couple orders of magnitude, than the best primary standards. And there's not only one atom that can do that. There are clocks based on ytterbium atoms, strontium atoms, aluminum ions, which is what we have here. There are a bunch of different atomic species that have been identified as really promising for the redefinition of the second eventually. And there's no consensus as to how that's actually going to go. How do you choose one atom over the other atom? What are the figures of merit that you use to really decide? So it's a really interesting process. There are a lot of people working on it around the world to try to make the most accurate and the most precise clock, and we'll see how this goes over the next 10 years or so. The clock that I work on in particular is an aluminum ion clock. In general, when you're scouring the periodic table, looking for an atom or an ion that's going to serve as a really good frequency reference, what you want to look for is an extremely narrow transition in a resonance in the atom or ion. So that happens with particular atoms just due to the atomic structure. But that's the first thing. You need a very narrow transition, high quality factor that serves as a good frequency reference. That has to do with the precision of the clock. The other thing that you look for is that the frequency of that transition isn't affected very much by the environment. So things like electric fields and magnetic fields surrounding the ion can perturb the frequency, and that will lead to an instability in the clock or a loss of accuracy in the clock. So the reason that we have pursued aluminum in particular is that it has both of those qualities. It has this extremely narrow, the lifetime limited Q, a quality factor of 10 to the 17, transition from the ground state, the ion, and it also has an anomalously low sensitivity to environmental effects like temperature or, you know, surrounding electric and magnetic fields. The thing that's really unique about aluminum, there are other atoms and ions in the periodic table that have those characteristics. The thing that's really unique about aluminum is that we don't have a way to directly laser cool and detect the state of the aluminum ion. So the kinds of experiments that we do, they really rely on the ability to trap the atoms, laser cool them close to absolute zero. And when we're doing the spectroscopy of the atoms, so that means the process by which we lock a laser beam to the resonance frequency in an atom, we need to detect the state of the atom. And aluminum doesn't have an accessible transition for allowing the laser cooling and the detection. So while it was identified many years ago, so in the early 1980s, as a really promising system, we didn't really know how to get at it because we didn't have the tools to do that. But it's been a while now. It's been about 15 years or a bit more. Dave Wineland, who started the group that I work in, the Ion Storage Group, figured out that you can apply some techniques from quantum computing in order to enable the cooling and detection of this otherwise inaccessible system. So that's why we call this a quantum logic clock. We're really using some of the basic ingredients of a quantum computer just to do any experiment whatsoever on the aluminum ion system. So the way this works, in our case, we have ion trap. We trap the ions in electric fields. We first trap an ion that we know how to laser cool and detect. In our case, that's magnesium. And then via their Coulomb repulsion, we can simultaneously trap the aluminum ion along with the magnesium ion. They line up along a line in the center of the trap. Because they're coupled together strongly, we can, by laser cooling magnesium, we also laser cool aluminum. We actually get close to the quantum mechanical ground state of motion. When we're locking a laser to the resonance in aluminum, we need to detect whether it's in the ground state or it's been excited to the excited state. And to do that, we map information via a quantum logic gate from aluminum to magnesium, and then detect the state using magnesium. So that's one of the things that makes this clock really unique.
So is that, I think I can remember writing something about this in the past. So are you entangling the two atoms? Is that the trick?
That's essentially right. By entangling the two atoms and then making a measurement on one of them, you know something about the state of the other atoms. That's one of the fundamental properties of an entangled state, that measuring the state of one of the two entangled particles tells you something about the other entangled particle. That's right.
Okay, well, good luck to David with his atomic clock project. And you never know, one day, in the not too distant future, that product might be available on a chip. But meanwhile, at NIST, there's a wider project to put a whole range of NIST standard onto a chip, which can then be sent out into industry and to scientific researchers. Hamish, why do they want to do this?
Well, I spoke to someone called John Kitching at NIST, and he is the person who, you know, is sort of in charge of this NIST on a chip program and has instigated it. And He told me this. You know, at the moment, if you've got a very precise piece of equipment that needs to be calibrated, at the moment, you know, you might send that to NIST and they will do the calibration and then send it back to you. And of course, there's, you know, there's time involved there. There's the cost of transport. There's the cost of, you know, doing something at NIST. And John's idea is that you could have NIST sent to you in the form of a chip. So, you know, for example, if your precise piece of equipment is a clock or a timekeeper, you could send an atomic clock on a chip out and have it installed into the piece of equipment. And then that piece of equipment could be constantly calibrated using the chip. And, you know, it's not only clocks. You can imagine a lot of other calibration technologies could be integrated onto chips and then installed into equipment. And that would, you know, save an incredible amount of time and money in the calibration process. So that's the basic idea behind NIST on a chip.
The idea of actually having to send your equipment to NIST, yeah, it sounds quite antiquated, doesn't it? But I imagine the reality of putting all this cutting edge tech onto a little chip is, yeah, that's definitely not a trivial thing to have to do. So did John talk about some of the technological challenges of actually doing that?
Yeah, he did. And you know, one thing that he pointed out is that the technology that you put on the chip, it doesn't have to be state-of-the-art, cutting-edge, David Hume, aluminium clock technology. As long as the technology is good enough and you can get it to run on the chip, it's a useful thing to do. So there are technological challenges, but, you know, NIST is, you know, as far as I can tell, is, you know, really keen on this. And, you know, they have made major breakthroughs in putting some of this calibration technology onto chips.
Okay, well, let's hear what John Kitchen had to say about it.
Okay, so NIST on a chip is a relatively new program at NIST. And the motivation for NIST on a chip is the following. Throughout the United States and the world, there is a lot of calibrations that are done basically every single day. I think that NIST gets something like 14,000 things a year to calibrate. These are things like gauge blocks or photodetectors or low noise oscillators. And basically, organizations who need to have calibrated systems send these things to us. And we compare them against our in-house standards, which are among the best in the world. And we send them back to the user with some calibration that says what the performance or for example, the length of the gauge block actually is. And then the user can then use that as a calibrated system. And this has worked fine for many decades. The problem is that it's a very cumbersome and time-intensive process. You have to ship things around all the time. The calibrations can only be done at certain very well-established facilities like NIST or other metrology labs and calibration labs. And so this creates a lot of the calibration process. It makes it a very complicated thing. So here's the idea with NIST on a chip. Suppose that we could make a chip that was fabricated in the same ways that integrated circuits are. So chips that could be mass produced on wafers with very high volume and at very low cost. And suppose that this chip could realize some set of SI units. For example, suppose it could realize the meter or the second or the volt or the kilogram. And suppose that this chip then could be so low cost that it could be integrated into actual systems or used by users in their organization. For example, these could be deployed on factory floors. They could be integrated into instruments. That would really revolutionize the way that calibrations are done. Instead of people sending us things at NIST, now what we would do is we would make the standard and essentially send it to the user and allow the user to do the calibrations themselves. So this is in some ways a sort of revolutionary paradigm for the calibration with the way it's done basically at NIST and throughout the world. Now, of course, the challenging part is how you make these chips and how one goes about making things that have some traceability to the SI, the Système International, that is the basis for basically all physical units, while at the same time making something that is low cost and small and low power. And so that's the real challenge of NIST on a chip, the real technical challenge. It's a combination of achieving SI traceability, but also achieving small size, low power, and in particular, a high degree of manufacturability and reduction in cost. Now, our group has been involved in this area for a number of years. We actually started working on things like this over 15 years ago, almost 20 years ago now, with the development of the chip-scale atomic clock. And the chip-scale atomic clock is a device that is, it's an atomic clock. It's a clock that is based on quantum transitions in atoms. And it incorporates elements of silicon micromachining in order to achieve small size and low power. The way that we do that is we etch holes in silicon wafers, and then we fill those holes with rubidium or cesium atoms that provide the frequency reference. The whole thing then can be extremely small. We've made clocks, physics packages for clocks that are about the size of a grain of rice. That technology was developed further, and a commercial product now exists, the chip-scale atomic clock product, and that is something that you can buy. And the big advance that commercial product achieved was an almost 50 times reduction in the power consumption compared to any previous atomic clock. And that's why it's important. These clocks run on 100 milliwatts of power, and they can be run on a battery for several hours or even up to several days. And so they're very important for low-power portable applications. I also note that, you know, in the world today, we are seeing, over the last 20 or 30 years, increasing drive toward miniaturization and portability. 30 years ago, computers were things that maybe were in large rooms or possibly on a desktop, and now we have portable computers that we can use in a coffee shop without any power source and have massive amounts of computing power. Similarly, communication devices. 30 years ago, we had telephones that were attached to a line. Now we have very powerful smartphones that have a huge amount of functionality that run on a battery and that connect up to the world via wireless networks. And even in space, what we find is that there is a movement toward small, low-power satellites such as CubeSats or PicoSats that are very small things. They run on very little power. But one can have many of these systems that are available or that are in use orbiting the Earth with levels of increased functionality. And so the hope is with NIST on a chip that really all of this movement toward portable battery-operated applications can be greatly facilitated in terms of the metrology by allowing low-cost, portable, low-power metrology instruments to be integrated into these things. And, you know, I really believe that if we get this done, and that is an if, there's a lot of work to do, it will really change the way that everything is, the world works. Imagine every gas pump and every grocery store scale that is calibrated to the SI intrinsically, and there's no need for any kind of repeated calibration. That would be a fantastic thing and would enable vast new possibilities in terms of trade and exchange of goods in a very, very well-controlled and well-defined way.
Well, I mean, that idea of launching these chips into space, yeah, that makes it sound even more sci-fi and futuristic. And Hamish, I know you caught up with another researcher, Michelle Stevens, who explained a bit more about this wacky idea.
Yeah, I spoke to Michelle. She is interested in developing technologies for detecting light at very, very low levels. And so that starts at the sort of single photon level and then goes up a bit from there. And she spoke about putting these radiometers, as they're called, electromagnetic radiation detectors onto chips and launching them into space on a CubeSat platform. And in the interview that's coming up, I think she spoke about a tense few hours when they thought that they had lost their satellite after it had been launched.
So I'm Michelle Stevens. I'm a physicist at NIST. I'm the project lead for the laser radiometry project in the Sources and Detector Group. And one of the projects that we work on is building a NIST on a chip detectors for space, for CubeSats, with the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics at the University of Colorado. And it's been very fun for us. We have worked with them to put up onto a CubeSat a detector that measures the solar spectral irradiance. It's a small detector. It's 20 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 30 centimeters. That's the whole satellite, actually. And it replaces a much larger one that's up on a space station. It was launched in November, and we've been happy to see that we're getting good results and good matches to the previous measurements that have been up on the space station. One of the funny stories is that we lost contact with the CubeSat for 2 weeks and was able to work with an amateur in New Zealand who found their beacon and helped them to find the CubeSat again. The detectors are silicon micromachine detectors that use vertically aligned carbon nanotubes as absorbers. They are micromachined heat links. The detectors themselves are about 1 millimeter by 3 or 4 millimeters. And then the rest of the optics that are in front of the CubeSat are what make it fit into the instrument package itself is 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters.
Great. Well, thanks, Hamish. And when Hamish was in Boulder, he also visited the University of Colorado. And while in the state, he also went to the capital, Denver, for the April meeting of the American Physical Society. So coming up in the next few weeks, I'm sure you'll be hearing from many more researchers from the university and the conference. Okay, well, to wrap things up today, we've also got a quick roundup of some of the research highlights making the headlines on our website this week. Hamish, you've got an intriguing story about Roman acoustics.
That's right. Our Rome correspondent, Edwin Cartledge, asked the question, did the Romans build seismic invisibility cloaks? This is a story about some seismic researchers, or a seismic researcher, who is on his holidays in a town called Autun in central France. And when he was there, sort of looking at the Roman ruins in the town, he saw an aerial photograph of the foundations of a Gallo-Roman theater that was buried under a field just up the road. And the thing that struck him is that the semicircular structure bore an uncanny resemblance to one half of an invisibility cloak. And this researcher, his name is Stéphane Brulé, he had done some work on protecting buildings using seismic metamaterials. And the idea is that you could surround a building with a pattern of holes or posts or something like that. And when a seismic wave came across this pattern, it would be deflected and the building would be saved from the earthquake. And he realized that perhaps, maybe by mistake or maybe knowingly, the Romans had actually built amphitheaters using the same patterns.
Wow, so is this this structure, is that pretty much unique for the Romans, or were there any other similar sites?
Well, the interesting thing is that once he caught on to this, he looked at plans of various Roman amphitheaters, including the Colosseum in Rome. And what he did is basically put down a plan of an amphitheater and over top of it put down a plan for a seismic metamaterial or an invisibility cloak. And he realized that that there was a perfect match between how the foundations of these structures were built and how people were building invisibility cloaks. So it seems to be a common thing that the Romans used. Now, of course, there's a big question. Is this just a coincidence? The Romans would build these structures in a circular manner. And of course, invisibility cloaks tend to be circles or concentric circles of material. So it could just be a coincidence. On the other hand, it's possible that, you know, over centuries, the Romans worked out the best way to build the foundations of a building in an earthquake zone. Because of course, Rome, for example, and much of Italy is very prone to earthquakes.
So, yes, it could be like sort of an engineering approach of sort of a technical trial and error rather than starting from the fundamental physics.
That's right, yeah. And now, now that Brulé has seen this, he's got together with some of his colleagues, and they're planning on building a model of this in real soil and testing it with using vibrations and seeing how the vibrations move through the foundations of these buildings. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, they look like invisibility cloaks that maybe could protect buildings from earthquakes, but I suppose they have to find out whether they actually behave in that way. So stay tuned. That's a really interesting story. The article is called "Did the Romans Build Seismic Invisibility Cloaks?" And that's up on the website. And you've got some news from the world of medical physics.
That's right, about biomedical physics, So neurological conditions or injuries that result in the inability to communicate, obviously it goes without saying they can be devastating. And patients with speech loss often rely on alternative communication devices that work by controlling a cursor to indicate letters that then spell out a word. And obviously, while these systems can enhance the quality of life, they can only produce around 5 to 10 words per minute, typically, which is far slower than the natural rate of human speech. And now, researchers from the University of California, San Francisco, have created what they call a neural decoder that can transform brain activity into intelligible synthesized speech at the rate of a fluent speaker. The decoder takes a two-stage approach. So first, a recurrent neural network decodes recorded brain signals into movements of the vocal tract. And then these movements are used to synthesize the speech. To find out more about the technicalities of it, and to actually listen to the system in action, take a look at the article, "Decoder Translates Brain Activity into Speech." So Hamish, you've also got an update, haven't you, about quantum computing?
Yeah, I mean, if you're a regular reader of Physics World, and who isn't, you know that there's a huge race on to develop quantum computers. And that's because quantum computers have enormous potential for solving certain problems in much shorter times than conventional computers. There are problems, though. Significant challenges must be overcome to develop practical quantum computers. Now, a team of scientists at Fudan University and the Institute of Physics of the Chinese Academy of Sciences have taken an important step forward by measuring the theoretically predicted value for the conductance of Mariana zero modes. Now, these are potential building blocks of a quantum computer. These modes are zero energy excitations in a topological superconductor, which is a material where the surface states differ from the bulk. Mariana zero modes are their own antiparticles. If two of them meet, both of them disappear, leaving behind only energy. This special property makes them ideal for topological quantum computing. You can read more about this latest research in "Quantum Computer Prospects Improve on the Surface" by Bence Borsak, who is a member of our contributors network and based at the University of Cambridge. And finally, James, I think we've got an article about air quality up on the website.
That's right, yeah. So interactions between aerosols and solar radiation can enhance temporary emission control measures That's according to researchers in China and the US. Taking account of these interactions in their simulations, the researchers predicted greater decreases in ground-level concentrations of fine particulate matter. Aerosol particles smaller than 2.5 microns are linked to millions of premature deaths each year worldwide. In China's Beijing, Tianjin, Hebei region, concentrations of these particles reach hazardous levels so often that the Chinese government restricts anthropogenic emissions during major events to ensure good air quality. But predicting the effectiveness of these measures is not simple. Weather conditions during the restriction can play a role, but feedback from aerosol radiation interactions must also be considered to achieve reliable outcomes. Where 2.5 micron particle concentrations are high, the surface receives less shortwave radiation, decreasing the temperature at ground level. This stabilizes the air column above, limiting atmospheric mixing and preventing particle dispersal. What's more, lower surface temperatures are typically accompanied by an increase in relative humidity, which enhances formation of secondary aerosols such as sulfate, nitrate, and ammonium aerosols. To test the influence of this feedback on the effectiveness of temporary control measures, Mi Zhao of Peking University, Beijing, and colleagues at the Beijing-based Institute of Urban Meteorology and at UCLA and Harvard University in the US used the WRF Chem model to simulate periods of 4 to 9 days with and without aerosol radiation interactions and emissions controls. As expected, the simulation showed that emission controls do improve air quality. More surprising was that the relationship between emission reduction and particulate matter was quadratic rather than linear. Find out more in the article, Sunshine Boosts Aerosol Controls. Okay, well, thanks for listening today, and don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast via Apple Podcasts or your chosen app. And also check out our other podcast, Physics World Stories. This month's episode looks at the future of the internet and some of the technologies that might transform our daily lives. Join us again next week. Bye. Physics World.